is a Building Bridges Your Community and Labor Report special. Strike watch? But strike support? Absolutely. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
The first New York City-wide transit strike in 25 years has ended. Local 100 walked out to stop the TA's 11th-hour pension ambush. They walked out strong, and they walked back in strength as well. While we don't have the full details of the proposed contract, we believe every listener should be proud that transit workers' union members stood up for justice. And just a short while ago, Ken and I were able to catch up with a very harried Arthur Schwartz, counsel for the Transport Workers Union Local 100. We begin our broadcast with that interview.
Arthur, Governor Pataki, subsequent to the announcement that TWU's workers agreed to return to work, was again provocative. In his gratuitous jab at the workers, he reiterated, almost with delight, the fines that have been imposed. 9 days lost pay, the $1 million fine assessed against the union. Could you first parse out for us where those fines derive from, how they were assessed, and then whether there's any mechanism for contesting them?
First, with respect to each worker, actually it's not 9 days fine. If they were out 3 days, they lose 6 days of pay. The two-day penalty includes the day that they weren't working. Those fines derive from the Taylor Law, and that was the law that was passed in 1968 following the transit strike of the year earlier. Those are pretty hard to get around unless you can show that you didn't participate in the strike, and I don't know that they've ever been gotten around. And I think it's something that workers who go out on strike understand is one of the consequences. Okay, the other penalties that people heard about was the contempt fines that Judge Jones came down with on the first day of strike. Said that he was fining the union $1 million a day for every day that it was out. Those fines are hardly a resolved question. I don't think that the Transit Authority is going to agree to reduce those fines, but there's still the potential for an application to the judge to reduce them. And we also have a pretty serious appeal pending concerning whether the union's constitutional rights were violated in the way that Judge Jones assessed the penalty. I mean, it's our position that the union was entitled to a jury trial. It's actually a criminal conviction. The law that the judge functioned under was about criminal contempt. And we think that the union was entitled to a jury trial, and that issue is up in an appellate court and may go up even higher. And so those fines are far from a resolved issue.
The additional threat that came from Mayor Bloomberg of additional fines per worker of $25,000 a day and the possibility of attaching their bank accounts, under what law is that? I know you tore those papers up in court, but was that a real threat?
No, it's total made-up press bite law. They've threatened those lawsuits before. We've moved to dismiss their lawsuits before. They say they're suing for public nuisance. There's so much case law that they can't do what they say they're doing. And in fact, we found a case where the city sued Con Edison after the 77 blackout under the similar theory, and the Court of Appeals said that they could sue for that. The Court of Appeals has basically said that in another case following the 1980 transit strike, said that an anti-union law firm brought a class action in public nuisance against TWU, and the Court of Appeals threw that out and said that it was basically the way that the courts had to function utilizing the penalties set forth in the Taylor Law. Unless somebody could show that the union engaged in some activity other than striking, like, you know, say they've gone in the streets and overturn cars and burn down a building, or then you might have a separate lawsuit. But the stuff that the mayor was talking about in Cardozo was really for press purposes, to make headlines and to try to scare the workers. But it was really, I think I described it the first day as hogwash, and I'll continue to describe it that way.
Well, let's talk about it not being a balanced law. I mean, the Public Employees Relation Board, which is a function of the Taylor Act, had not acted in terms of the MTA's demand on the table with regarding pensions, which is not a mandatory subject of collective bargaining. How are the penalties all being set against the union, and there's no pressure against management in a situation like this?
That's the fundamental problem with the Taylor Law. The Taylor Law doesn't really provide remedies for unions if the employer is bargaining in bad faith. The remedy is an order to bargain in good faith. I mean, sometimes if they, I've had a situation where an employer, City University, wanted to give pay increases to certain faculty members during contract negotiations, and we got PERB actually stopped them from doing that. I mean, so there are, sometimes there are remedies, but in the private sector, you have, you can strike. And if the employer commits an unfair labor practice, you can strike even during the term of a contract where you have a no-strike clause. In the public sector, it doesn't exist. You know, so there's a right away without the right to strike, there's a lack of balance, nothing that the agency and the law can do to really correct that.
Arthur, the case is set for a hearing, or at least it's been adjourned until January 20th. What can we expect there? Because we are always doing this towards an edge for people to support their sisters and brothers in TWU Local 100.
On January 20th, we will appear in court, and the judge on that date may or may not hold a contempt trial for Roger Toussaint, Ed Watt, and Darlene Lawson. A lot can happen between now and May 20th. The Attorney General may decide not to pursue those attempts, so we'll see. I mean, it could be that there's a trial. We're continuing to press the issue of a jury trial. We're actually arguing that issue on the, and we're not even arguing that issue in the appellate division until a week later.
Arthur, there hasn't been a public sector strike in New York City in many, many years. The TWU list went out 25 years ago. How do you think this will affect the temper of collective bargaining with the city unions, and even with private unions in terms of their resolve to enforce the contract?
I think it serves to raise the level of militancy in the labor movement. I don't know that it raises the level of militancy in the public sector. I can't see cops going out. I can't see firefighters going out. I certainly, given its current political situation, I can't see DC 37 going out, although there are people in there that would love to. You know, I think it sort of, you know, the notion of going out on strike and accepting the penalties for people in the private sector is a lot smaller. You lose a day of work, or 2 days of work, or 3 days of work, or a week of work, but your union isn't fined $3 million. So, you know, I think it could serve to promote militancy in the unions. There was uneven support for Local 100. Some union leaders were supportive of it. There was a conference call of all the union leaders in New York, or major union leaders in New York City, on Tuesday, with Roger, where I heard that before Roger got on the phone, there was some griping, but there were also a number of people on the phone who were extremely supportive, and I'm not just talking about Randy Weingarten. A number of union leaders who said, we're with you, we'll give you money, we'll give you, you know, whatever logistical support, you know, our members are very supportive, and, you know, we'll see whether, if those unions, you know, follow pace.
Although Roger is quoted as saying in the paper today that in terms of support from the broader labor movement, that a lot of people were willing to hold his coat but not willing to engage the fight.
Yeah, I think he said that in that call. He said, don't just hold my coat, but, you know, join me in the fight. And we'll see. You know, there continue to be good new people being elected to office in the labor movement. There's been a lot of turnover in the last 10 years, and I think that kind of stuff continues to happen. Workers aren't happy when their needs aren't getting taken care of. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, the TWU can just do what TWU does, and it sets an example, and then you see whether it goes further and whether people who have more trade unionist tendencies in the trade unions follow suit.
Do you see there being a push now to change or abolish the Taylor Law?
Well, there's always a push to change or abolish the Taylor Law, and certainly not going to happen while there's a Republican to control the state Senate. Maybe if the Democrats come into power, there'll be some modifications to the Taylor Law, but I don't even think the Democrats will legalize public employee strikes. Alan Hevesy said a couple of years ago when he was running for mayor that he would favor legalizing strikes among non-essential public employees, and he, like, immediately got attacked by all the other candidates who were running for mayor, including, I think, Mark Green. So I don't see the strike prohibition ever going away.
Much was made in the media who played a terrible, terrible attack dog role against the workers. Specifically, they made much hay over and exploited the role of the International, which in court repudiated the strike.
Right. I mean, the International, you know, in some ways they weren't supportive. And I don't even really want to go into it that much, because partly because this could happen again in 3, 6, 9, or 12 years. The International wasn't supportive. On the other hand, they didn't really do anything to undercut the union, the local. Some high up person in the International said to me, you know, you're lucky Sonny Hall retired. Because Sonny, what Mike O'Brien did was do what he needed to do to avoid contempt sanctions, which was to say, go back to work. But he didn't really take an aggressive role vis-a-vis the local. And so in that respect, when we were in court, you know, they basically supported our position before the strike started. And, you know, it's a mixed bag. I mean, I don't think their lack of support, it played into some media stuff. I don't think it got any workers not to support the strike. There were some interesting poll numbers yesterday. It looked like a majority of New Yorkers had come to support the union. And there was certainly an overwhelming number thought both Pataki and Bloomberg were doing a really terrible job at handling the strike. And what were they doing? They were out there denouncing the workers. So people saw through the media. I think Roger's speech on Wednesday, which was brilliant, when he talked about how Rosa Parks and Dr. King violated the law, and if, you know, Rosa Parks hadn't violated the law, we wouldn't be driving buses, we'd be sitting in the back of the bus. I mean, I thought that really rang true with a lot of people, not just Black and Hispanic people. People began to understand what, you know, what his point was.
And is there any sense of what seems to have disappeared, at least from the limelight, what happened with the disciplinary proceedings, which have been so onerous against transit workers, including Roger himself, prior to his becoming president of the union?
I think that there are agreements in place that are designed to lower the number of disciplines, and there were some in place in 2002 that didn't work, so there were some new strategies that we adopted, and, you know, that stuff I was actually involved in negotiations about, and I think, you know, there'll be an effort through both enforcement of what went on in 2002 and some more changes that the parties agreed to this year to lower the number of disciplines. So, I mean, hopefully, there's like a self-perpetuating machine in the Transit Authority that a bunch of lawyers who are afraid they wouldn't exist if they wouldn't have any reason for existing if they weren't pushing discipline. So it's like you wouldn't treat school children the way they treat transit workers. There's 15,000 disciplinary actions a year against 32,000 people. And these are grown men and women who get their hands slapped, you know, like at least once every other year, and they're expended from work or they're docked pay and kind of ridiculous. And I think it's part of what creates an atmosphere that results.
And lastly, now that the strike is over, at least for now, and some people think that the pressure's off, but public opinion does play a big role in this. What should people, what should unions, what should other organizations be doing to show their support for the transit workers?
I think that people should keep their ears open and watch their email, and I think there will be efforts by other unions and progressive organizations to help the TW deal with the fines that it faced. Certainly, if January 20th becomes a possible day for Toussaint Watt and Lawson to be up on charges, I would hope that people will be at the courthouse and supporting them. And probably the best way people can support TW if they're in unions is to get active in their unions and push their unions to be more militant and fight for what people need. And yeah, I wanted to add one other thing. Somebody asked me yesterday when I was walking out of the courthouse, do I think Roger gave in because he was facing a possible jail at 4 o'clock in the afternoon? And I said, absolutely not. I don't think that threat played one ounce of a role in Roger's decision to get people back to work. I think he was ready to go to jail if the judge wanted him to go to jail for what he believed in. And as he had said the night before, he said there's the law and there's justice, and he will always come down on the side of justice. And nobody should believe that the fines or the threats or the possible jail or the governor or the mayor had anything to do with his decision to put people back. The pain that New Yorkers were going through did have a role, you know, and I think that he always came down on the side of New Yorkers and trying to help. Bad about what was going on with New Yorkers, bad about going into a holiday weekend without mass transit. That played a role. And once I think the framework was on the table for a fair resolution, then he sent people back. He didn't wait to put it in writing, and you know, which was, we lawyers can sometimes take a while.
I can't help but ask one other thing. Anthony Lewis had pointed out in an article in the Daily News that at one point the firefighters became certainly understandably rambunctious relevant to contract issues, and they had been called by a city official thug, whereupon Mayor Bloomberg immediately repudiated that, said it was neither part of his kind of dialogue, not part of his upbringing, and so on. And then he seems to have had a remarkable memory lapse and deliberately and conscientiously really used the term thugs again and again against these workers, and terms like hostage, etc., which are so latent with impact on people's psyche these days. How do you respond to that? What are the implications in terms of the racial connotations of this?
Well, I think that poll yesterday really showed the impact of it, because he did polarize things. He polarized it racially because it was like Roger said, the transit workers are mostly Black and Hispanic these days. They're not Irish anymore. We're your neighbors. We're the person that lives next door to you, the person that lives below you, and we're not thugs. You know, we were the first ones at the World Trade Center, and we're the first ones to pull people out of smoky conditions in subways and to help people when they're lost. And my 2-year-old is telling me to get off the phone. And you know, I think that the connotation, what they did was really unfortunate, and you know, shows the divide between Pataki's, between Bloomberg and his money and his politics and where, you know, working people are in the city of New York.
Well, we'll submit to the mandates and the demands of the 2-year-old, which clearly take precedence here. And thank you very much for spending the time that you are with us. And certainly know that our listeners support TWU, Workers, Local 100. Arthur Schwartz, thank you very much.
Thank you, and have a happy New Year.
We're now joined by William Johnson, co-editor of Labor Notes, and Arthur Chiliotis, president of Communication Workers of America, Local 1180. You know, one of the important things that we need to look at is the whole role of organized labor, of coordinated support from the rest of the labor movement. I really didn't see them there outside of the first rally where all the leaders got up behind Roger Toussaint. What's happening with, or not happening, Arthur, with organized labor? And then I guess the whole question of whether any one of the municipal unions can bargain by itself.
Well, certainly the municipal unions cannot bargain by themselves effectively. They can attempt to bargain by themselves even if they're relatively large. But I think one of the things that I've seen over my 30 years bargaining contracts with the city of New York is that we do best when we bargain in coalition. Our raises have always been better historically that way. When we each go on our own, we're divided. And going back to Julius Caesar, the city's been very effective at dividing and conquering. And I think that a united labor front is key. I think every city worker should understand that Roger Toussaint is their hero, together with the Transport Workers Union, for the stand that they took. They said enough is enough. The line is drawn here, and you will not cross it. And I think that that for that, we need to salute them and support them.
The question is, and a lot of people with the strike being over aren't paying as much attention, unfortunately, to the ongoing negotiations. In what ways can we support them during this period when they're not really on the front page? And in what ways can the union support them?
I think that because the TW agreed to the press blackout, it's pretty hard to do anything that's visible right now. It's the nature of the negotiation that it's done behind closed doors with an attempt to for them to hammer out an agreement. And all parties have agreed to that. If the city or the MTA should break that agreement, then I think all bets are off and we're out in the streets again fighting for it. I know at my local, we were organizing Christmas caroling to do and hot coffee and donuts, and we understand that the Central Labor Council was putting together a fund to help transit workers get through this with an assessment of $1 a worker from the Central Labor Council. So those are some of the things that we were doing. We have a lot of our members have spouses who are in the TWU, and we've been trying to coordinate our support at the picket line during the 3 days of the strike and do what we can. Our stewards would go out and get donuts and coffee, whatever we could, to support them.
William Johnson, I want to also bring you into this discussion. And one of the things that I know is that you have a great deal of national sensitivity and knowledge. Continuing on this question, maybe we can look at some of the models or some of the instances in which there really have been community labor alliances so that when service workers, municipal workers, have actually needed support for bargaining for their contracts, they have accomplished same. And I know there are instances.
The Atlanta example is the most relevant because it revolves around public transportation. And there's a group down there that was formed fairly recently called the Transit Riders Union, and it is what it sounds like. It's a community labor group made up of people who use the public transportation down in Atlanta, and they have done support work with the union around contract campaigns, but also the union has kind of brought things back to them. And when there was a fare hike proposed, which I know all listeners in New York can certainly sympathize with transit riders trying to figure out how to fight around a fare hike. The Transit Workers Union worked with this Transit Riders Union and fought back the fare hike that was proposed in Atlanta earlier this year and actually defeated it. It's the kind of thing that would have been really helpful in coordinating support efforts, I think, up here in New York around the strike, because public transit, as everyone knows, affects everybody, and the union can only do so much on its own, and there needs to be coordinated support from the community for union efforts.
Well, there had been, with respect to them trying to close the token booths and limit the number of workers working in the stations. There were coordinated efforts with community groups with respect to that. I think there was more sympathy for the strike than the media would certainly acknowledge, but we shouldn't lose sight of that fact, and that there has been a long history of the transit riders working with the Transport Workers Union in dealing with issues affecting an MTA that doesn't give a damn about either the riders or the workers. I mean, that MTA board is a bunch of elitists put there by other than someone who wants to be president of the United States, George Pataki.
We always have to put this issue about the fight around the pensions in a bigger context. The corporate agenda certainly has been really begin to decimate what's been accomplished in terms of health benefit packages and to really completely destroy the pension funds. William, why don't you address some of that and Bill as well?
This really does fit into that larger context that people have been following things going on with auto, where Delphi, which is an auto parts company, has declared bankruptcy and essentially said it's going to shed most of its obligations to its employees. And pensions have been, you know, a key issue in all of these types of fights. And I think it's partly because these companies are looking to save money, but it's also partly because in airlines and in steel and in auto, and now I think in the public sector, some of them are getting the sense that the unions are not, you know, they've seen some of the fragmentation around the AFL-CIO split, and they've seen signs of disunity. And there's a sense, I think, to some degree, that the companies, just as Arthur said, I think Roger drew a line in the sand. I think the companies are also kind of testing the unions and seeing how far can we push things and, you know, how much can we force on them. And I think that is why it's so important that TWU went on strike. I think, you know, Arthur's absolutely right. You have to draw a line somewhere. And, you know, this strike, the Northwest Airlines strike, are two of the only places where we've seen unions really step up and say, no, we're not going to take these cuts. And, you know, I think those are really important instances, and they're things that we need to all get behind.
Arthur, how does this affect the further negotiations of other unions? How does this is in a context of the negotiations of the last year or two in the city, the givebacks. Put this in the context of what's happened in the last year or two and how it will affect the future.
We have been pretty much a divided labor movement when it comes to negotiations. Everyone feels they can go out on their own and get their best deal, and that has not worked to our benefit in the long run. We live in a world where the employer points to pattern bargaining, and the history of arbitration awards has been that patterns are usually followed once they're set. So it's important that the first union out set a very positive pattern. If they fail to do so, if it's one that others can't build upon, then it creates a lot of problems, as with the PBA arbitration award. So given that atmosphere, it makes sense for people to be bargaining together in coalitions in their own best interests. Yet, for some reason, labor leaders choose not to do that. I have been a loud ringing advocate for it, as have other leaders in the MLC, but not enough of us seem to be coming together to bring people together in that fight against the employer. I think that what we see here in Roger's stand is it's time for us to find the strength to stand up and say, okay, this has to stop. There are a number of things that need to be looked at. For example, first of all, the New York City employer retirement system is fully funded. There is no impact that is substantial with respect to the not being able to pay for the pensions that have currently been earned. So that's not an issue. What is an issue? The issue is that the New York City and other local employers throughout the state got stupid over the fact that they were making so much money off the stock market that they didn't have to make contributions to the pension funds. So they assumed that they would never have to make contributions to the pension funds, when prior to the 90s boom, they were contributing 15, 20, even 30% of payroll to pension funds. Well, P.S., it went down to zero. Well, now it's back to what, 10, 12%? Big deal. What did you expect, to pay nothing? In fact, the employees do contribute to pension funds at 3%, depending on the tier that they're in. They were contributing more than the employer was, and that was never looked at. Well, here we are now where the employer has to make some contribution, and they're shocked, surprised, and bewildered over it. Well, if you were stupid enough not to budget for it, then you should be holding the bag. Don't lay it on the workers. And so we go forward. We have a country where we do not have a national health care system, even though government entities, be they federal, state, or local, are paying the bill for health care in this country. Over 60% of all health care costs are being borne by government entities, be it the federal government with Medicare and Medicaid, state governments with Medicaid and their employees, the federal government with its employees, Veterans Administration. We know that private employers are having a problem paying health care. On a global economy, if you buy that paradigm, I don't buy it, but we're not competitive because of the fact that our health care costs are nearly double our next competitor. And so if we're paying on average over $5,000 per capita for health care, and the next country is paying $2,500 per capita for health care, we put our goods at a disadvantage in terms of cost. Well, that burden should be carried on a national scale by a national health care system that's based on a broad-based tax that doesn't just include wages, but includes all income, especially dividends and stock options, so that you have a funded health care system that's borne by everyone, and you allow America's workers to be on a more level playing field. Not that they'll ever be on a totally level playing field. But having said all that, moving towards a national health care system, why state and local governments aren't demanding it, I don't understand.
If you look at the demographics of the workforce in TW Local 100 and the people who are most dependent on public transit, now, it's no accident that the city is willing to let slide the contracts for union members and the services for community members who are overwhelmingly African-American and Latino. And Arthur brought up earlier public support for the strike. There were some really interesting statistics. And in terms of people thinking if TWU Local 100's demands were fair, 75% of African-Americans in the city thought they were fair, 71% of Latinos in the city thought they were fair, only 38% of white New Yorkers thought the demands were fair. And so the racial breakdown in terms of people's perceptions of the strike, I think, reflect the racial divide that this strike really kind of brings to the fore. And I think Roger Toussaint was right to bring that issue up. You know, whenever that comes up, the media always immediately says, oh, he's playing the race card, totally inappropriate. I think Bloomberg called it despicable for him to bring up race in this issue. And I think it's something that needs to get talked about more in the labor movement, and particularly in these fights around public resources.
And it does indeed. And we have to leave it there. And we'd like to thank Arthur Chiliotis, president of CWA Local 1180, and William Johnson, co-editor of Labor Notes, Strike Support Specialist on Building Bridges. There's a war on the-